Pig session number 10613, reel 6.
Major Charles Burden Taylor, reel 6. I want now to look at some more general aspects of the campaign in 1940. And the first thing I'd like to ask, you have touched upon it before, a bit more detail perhaps, is how well do you thought the other ranks performed, the actual troops, in action?
As far as I'm concerned, they were absolutely first class. It's very difficult to describe any one particular thing, shall we say, but the main point is that whatever they were asked to do, they did. And there are various times when I'm quite certain one might say that initiative was used, but they responded to all the training. And I don't think one can say more than that. The self-discipline was extremely good. In other words, they didn't have to be forced into anything. And any straight orders that came out, they were cheerfully and very quickly obeyed. And I think I might add the question of cheerfulness, because it's a typical Geordie trait, and most of our people were Geordie, mostly pitmen from the northeast, and one almost felt that the more you gave them to do, the more cheerful they were in doing it. And in other words, every man did his job.
And that continued right up to the evacuation?
Absolutely. No doubt at all. I'm very proud, the basis of seeing them going across the beaches, basically, as we know, there's a question of artillery fire was already coming into Dunkirk, and there's the evidence of bombing too. And when we had to move, then the thing was to move by artillery formation, which in other words was every section worked as an individual unit, and the whole company was well spread out to avoid casualties. And you'd think they were doing this in the middle of Fenham Barracks.
What about the NCOs? Were they and the relationship between them and the officers and the men? Did it all work well? Were the NCOs as competent as you'd have hoped? Were the officers as competent as you'd have hoped?
I think that one might say that when the war first broke out, and I think I mentioned earlier, the Jackie Churchill, our brigadier, was a pretty hot number, and he insisted on very high standards, and that ran right through from, from your officers down through the warrant officers and NCOs down to the men themselves. And I think it might be a point that a lot of officers were lost, a lot of warrant officers and NCOs were lost. When I took over A Company, I had one sergeant, and he basically was the sergeant major. You don't get casualties, shall we say, if people are not there in the front line doing their job and doing it properly.
We've discussed the roles of officers and NCOs in peacetime. What about in action? Did the officer have a special role, in your opinion, to be a good officer in action?
I think this might be getting down to a lot of detail, but I think it might be fair enough to say that if an officer or a senior NCO or a warrant officer, for that matter, shall we say in a dug-in position, was seen to be moving about in the open. I don't mean giving away position or anything like that, but he wasn't stuck in a trench somewhere. I think that sort of example, that life was not all that bad, or if you like, that he was prepared to take a little bit more danger than anybody else, that could be one of the factors which allowed the chaps to understand that the situation wasn't as grave as it could be.
But when officers were killed, didn't that have a reverse effect? If they're there to demonstrate that things aren't that bad, and then if they get killed, did the men and NCOs they took over? They managed to get past that, didn't they?
I would say, from the point of view, you've hit on a very good point there on the question of taking over. I mean, the sergeant that I'm telling you about, he readily just stepped into the breach, and in A Company. And became the company sergeant major of A Company at that time. Similarly, corporals became platoon commanders. I don't recall anyone, in fact, being well, shall we say, adversely affected, or even commenting that, you know, my officer had been killed, and showing any, what can you say, psychological aspect.
What about the training? Had the training been well directed? Was the sort of warfare that you met the same type as you'd been expecting? Because the blitzkrieg tactics of the Germans, were they quite what you'd been expecting? Was your training adequate to cope with it?
That's a very difficult question to answer, because I have a feeling that we were probably thrown into war with a certain amount of last war, what can you say, thinking. Martel was a great tank man, and he expounded, I think, the role of tanks, or the potential role of tanks. And for that matter, I'm sure that that was the reason that we had the 50 Div being a motor division, which in fact was not, or sorry, a motorized division, as opposed to a motor division, where all the troops were lifted in their own 1,500 weights. We travelled in three tonners. But that was a compromise between the two. Also, I think a two brigade division is probably easier to handle under those circumstances. As a quick moving division than a normal infantry division. But I think that the question you're posing is one that we went to war. The thoughts could well be people looking over their shoulders to the first war. Training was concentrated. I don't think we ever really let up in getting the training going the whole time. The fact that we didn't expect life to become a blitzkrieg, I think, is something which perhaps wasn't realised at the top. Otherwise, I think we would have been given more training in it. Or perhaps it was realised too late and the war was upon us. And the main thing was to get us, you know, physically fit, fighting fit, at least to act in a simple infantry role.
How about your weapons? Were they adequate? Were they as good as it appeared the Germans had, in your view?
I think that's a tricky one too, because one's got to go right through the spectrum of weapons. Apropos this business of blitzkrieg and speed, forward tanks and so on, our tank, anti-tank defence, was basically the boys' anti-tank rifle, which I gather on one occasion successfully saw off a German motorcyclist when it was hit, and I gathered the bike went over one side of the dike and the rider went over the other. But as far as penetrating a tank, I haven't come across anyone who's told me that it ever did. Whereas nowadays, of course, an infantry battalion does have 17-pounders, and that's a complete change. The tanks that we saw ahead of us, there was one Mark I tank that looked rather like a spider, and I can only say it might have been difficult to hit, but I seem to remember it only had a machine gun, so it really was mobile firepower, and that was all, not a tank-v-tank weapon. I mean, the carrier platoon that we had more firepower than a squadron of that sort of tank.
So, with the exception of the boys, how about the rest of your weaponry?
Well, it wasn't... It wasn't all that number of years since the Bren appeared. Some people said the Bren was too accurate, but that's difficult to really substantiate, unless you're thinking of a defensive position when you want a fair spread of fire, if you're going to have defensive fire put down on fixed lines. But the Bren was a good weapon compared with the Lewis, which it superseded, because the Lewis itself had numerous stoppages, whereas the Bren, I think, was three, and very simple stoppages to rectify. From the point of view of rifles, well, in my humble opinion, the Lee Enfield rifle is still the best weapon that one could ever come across. We've got lots of nice, pretty things nowadays. But it was an extremely good weapon. 2-inch mortar, very useful, either with HE or smoke, and of course the 3-inch mortar had its place to play as well.
So you didn't feel that much outgunned, so to speak, by the Germans?
No, I don't think that was necessarily the case. I think we might have been out-tanked, but that was the nature of the beast. I think the biggest problem was that the lack of information as to what was going on, it's very difficult for anyone to be critical about that, because that is just, I mean, war is organized chaos. But if you haven't got the communications, then it's very difficult to be able to communicate from top to bottom, except by, shall we say, donar or in person. But the question of wireless communications was virtually nil at that time.
So that was a constant feeling of being out of touch. Was that just you, at company level, or do you think it went higher to battalion? And
It'd be difficult for me to say at battalion level, because I must confess that on the Arras attack, when General Martel suddenly appeared in a car, army car, and to see him there, at least there was some, shall we say, some communication between Div and Brigade and our own local position at battalion and company level. So there must have been communication backwards somewhere along the line, and from memory that would be the Royal Signals doing it between those higher formations.
But at company level you felt...
In a way we were out of it. I think I mentioned that at Carvel, when we put in this attack through Carvel, there were nobody in Carvel, but it's neither here nor there, we were sniped and mortared when we took up positions at the other side. I sent somebody back because there was a local French armoured car, and I understood from him that he was withdrawing. Well, I reckoned that that was going to leave, he'd be the last chap out. And so I had no question of coming up on the air and saying, "Hello, Peter One, what do I do?" or "Permission to withdraw," or whatever. And when I'd lost two runners, then I felt that one had to take action on one's own.
Now, I wanted to ask you about this question of companies. Were you a C company or A company at Carvel?
I was A company.
At
Carvel.
What? Now, that means you'd left C company before it was... It ran into quite serious trouble in the Ypres area. How did you feel about the destruction of your old company? Because it was destroyed.
Well, it's the sort of thing that all I heard was that C company, one chap had got out, and came the message that they were all either killed, wounded, or taken prisoner. And having been with C Company since 37, including for that matter with the carrier platoon, because I was always at Stanley, then it was a little bit of a blow that, the lad should have gone in that way. On the other hand, that's just part of the war.
It didn't upset you that much then?
Well, no. I better be careful what I say in that respect, because I don't recall. At that time it was a question of getting on with the job, and if you were then commanding A company, then you jolly well got on with the job, and that was that. And there's no question of sort of trying to push the days back and say, well, yesterday, if I'd been with C company, things might have been different or whatever. In fact, they would have been different, because I would have been a prisoner of war at that time. I might have had perhaps a little feeling of relief that the day before I'd come from Charlie Company as second in command to take over a company.
To get back into the chronological thing then, you were on the train on the way back to Borden and trying to contact your parents. Were you successful in that?
At that time, as it turned out, I wasn't. All the way along the line, wherever we had a stop, WVS and other letters plied us with tea and biscuits and so on, which was great. And I put my home telephone number on a cigarette packet and asked someone if they would possibly just phone my mother. My father's dead at this time. And subsequently, when I got to Borden, I just... had a good sleep, confident that my people had been told, and I let everybody else go and use the phones and so on. And then finally I rang up and found a speechless sister, because in actual fact they hadn't heard from me in any way, and in fact I think by that time Dunkirk had been declared as being closed.
So they'd assume you'd been taken prisoner?
They'd assume that I was missing casualty one way or another.
You went to Borden, and then what?
Then I went We went up to Knutsford, and I'd had some nick, some problem with the foot, and so I was pushed into hospital.
What was that problem?
Well, it was a little bit of septicemia. I was reported actually as wounded, but I don't remember being wounded at all. And so it was rather a nice little telegram to get. But thank goodness it was after I'd got home, after hospital. And when I was having, I think it was a fortnight sick leave or something like that.
And so you were in the hospital in Knutsford?
Yep, in the Poor Law Institute.
You well treated?
Exceptionally well treated. There was a massive nurse, or sister I suppose, who through the swinging doors used to look after it extremely well. But there were three or four of us, I think, in the ward at the time, and we used to sneak out and make ourselves a cup of tea when she wasn't looking. And of course the doors used to swing open like a tornado coming through. And in broad Lancashire, they'd say, "You lot, you boogers have been at it again." So we used to cower under her, what can I say, her whip in a way. But no, she was extremely good. I had come with this foot business. I wanted to get a pair of shoes somewhere. And they must have had every shoe shop up to the hospital to try and fit me out. No, their service and kindness couldn't have been better.
And from there, you were in, how were you in long before you went on leave?
Not really, no. I think probably about a week. And then a couple of weeks leave, I think.
How were you treated? You know, you'd been very well treated on the train. You know, people had been treating you almost as returning victors. When things had calmed down a little and you went on leave, was there any sort of stigma attached to the retreat and the evacuation?
The withdrawal, you mean?
The withdrawal.
Well, let's go back to the time that we were when we arrived in Knutsford. This gives you the answer, I think, and that is that we found that transport apparently was very short, and a local appeal had gone out to anyone with a car, and petrol was rationed at that time. Would they go to the station and help, move us from wherever we had to go? So I was carted off by a motor car from Knutsford Station to the camp in the first instance before going into hospital. And there's no question, they were using their petrol, they were looking after us to get us back into shipshape order. And they were being terribly kind and most enthusiastic.
And back in Durham, in Newcastle?
And in Newcastle, exactly the same. No problem on that. I think the whole country seemed to feel that this getting so many people out was a tremendous, almost a victory. I mean, it was a tremendous achievement, of that there's no doubt. And thank goodness the weather was so good, which allowed us not to lose people on the way over, or too many people on the way over.
After your leave, where did you report to?
I reported to Rugeley in Staffordshire, but the battalion had just moved on, I think, the day before, or a couple of days before, down to the south coast into the Weymouth area. So I just moved on from there and joined the battalion in that area. And then took over C Company.
You went into C Company.
Yep.
Were you commanding or back in your second?
No, I took over C Company as a company commander in my own right and got my captaincy. Not a company commander, in those days was a captain.
And where exactly were C Company based in the Weymouth area?
In the Weymouth area, a house, or the area of a house, immediately up from Weymouth. There was a road that went up from Weymouth, I think, to Maiden Newton, or it went inland anyway, straight north, and off that road this house was located, and C Company was in that area. That's when I got my greatcoat back.
What you were on coastal defence duties. What coastal defences were being established? Was there anything there when you got there?
Well, I wasn't actually. I mean, we were as a battalion on coastal defence, but I was a reserve company, and had to go digging in reserve positions.
What kind of positions were you digging?
Well, it's just straightforward company positions and the straightforward trench works. And on the high ground just behind Weymouth, other companies were in fact literally on beach defence.
Were these sort of straightforward positions, were they still based on the sort of First World War pattern of interconnecting, or were they more of the slip trench Second World War pattern?
Very much more Second World War. I suppose that in the long run we would have linked up, because obviously that would have been a necessity had we been, shall we say, under fire and that sort of thing, and if you wanted to resupply. But basically it was very much on the small unit defensive position.
Was this something you'd learned from your experiences in France, or...?
No, I think this was just straightforward learning, I would say, pre-war, and any of the exercises we'd done, or tutes that we'd done, since the beginning of the war.
So not a change?
Nope.
Where were you billeted?
House area, just behind the town of Weymouth.
And all the troops were in houses as well?
No, they were in that area... in the area, I think we had enough accommodation for the company at that time in the area of that house and the outbuildings.
And what sort of routine, daily routine or lifestyle did you establish?
Well, basically, I suppose the lifestyle style really was to get this position, the reserve position, ready. The usual administrative chores of, shall we say, keeping fit, medical inspections, pay parades, certain amount of, shall we say, verbal training from the point of view of lectures and demonstrations, just normal training of perhaps a more offensive nature, because in a reserve position, and if we'd been in a reserve position on the hills, then we could well have been pulled out of that to take up a counterattack role if the invasion had come in at that particular area.
The companies didn't rotate then?
Not at that point, no. No, I stuck there. As far as I know, D Company stuck really in front of me on the beaches. B Company, I think, was on the other side of Portlandville.
Was there, during this time, June going into July, were there any alerts about parachutists or...
Not at that, no. We got a lot of bump, and if you like, this is part of the training world, but we got a certain amount of, what can you say, information about potential, what the attack might be. In other words, it could be, you know, preceded by a bombardment, including parachute dropping. There's even a suggestion that there might be odd people already in the community who... That sort of thing, yes. I don't think that was taken seriously, frankly. But this was a suggestion that if one saw anything suspicious or anything out of the ordinary, then it should be investigated.
Did your company ever see anything suspicious or out of the ordinary?
Not at that time, no. Nothing that I can recall.
And you stayed here how long about?
Oh, that's just a matter of weeks. And that is all. Mind, when I think about it, yes, it would be weeks, because certainly the Ford companies had the opportunity to build beach defences, and that wouldn't be done really overnight. On the other hand, we were learning fast, because I think it was Fred Kirkup's company who... meticulously organized the question of the tide going out, and they would then zoom out and put up a double apron barbed wire fence, and which they did very efficiently, very quickly, and typically of the teamwork that we had around at that time, and had had for that matter the whole time. But of course angle iron pickets or screw pickets in sand don't hold up very much. And a very dejected company appeared after the tide had come in and gone out, because it virtually destroyed this lovely double apron fence which they'd so meticulously built in very quick time.
So, did you have enough material to build all these defences and such? Like, I know you weren't directly involved, but were
no.
the battalion well
oh,
supplied
no.
in the necessities?
We were... Yes, I think that would be fair enough, because those things had to be done, I recall that we were short on weaponry. In fact, well, I think that I had... It was, shall we say, it was a long time, or it appeared to be a long time, before we were fully up to scale with rifles, bayonets. Everyone had a rifle. Brems, 2-inch mortars, and of course the 3-inch mortars and machine guns. But I wouldn't like to specify a date. Later on, we found... I mean, this was the sort of thing that one got really terribly enthusiastic, that somebody found a .5 machine gun from some war or other, probably the First War, and that was promptly put into a position along the front, as though it was, you know, made of gold. It was another weapon.
Did you have the ammunition for it?
Well, I didn't take charge of this, but as far as I was concerned, it was active, yes.
Do you remember any incidents while you were there? Anything come to mind?
No, I think it could... Well, the one thing that did happen, which we had a grandstand view, we were dug in all round this house as well, but was, I think, it was the first Stuka attack on Great Britain. And it, I mean Stuka, and this was an attack on Portland Bill, the naval area. And as I say, we had a grandstand view of this, and this was the first time, shall we say, that Britain had been violated as far as we were concerned. But other than that, I don't think... We just got on with our digging, we got on with our training, and we thought of watching out for anything unusual.
What about your social life, recreations? Was there a company mess?
We had a company mess. We had both, actually, a company mess and... Well, all companies had their messes, and there was a battalion headquarters mess.
What was the company mess?
Well, that was just our five officers, and that was in the house itself. Everything surrounded this house.
Was it informal?
Oh, very much informal, yep.
So that would you just eat together?
Yeah. Oh, yes, yes. But you might, shall we say, after hours, you may read or talk or, I mean, just the usual socialising from that, but pretty basic. I mean, I don't remember any... Well, we didn't have any company mess silver or anything like that.
Who ran it?
We ran it within the company itself, and one of us would take responsibility just for providing whatever we felt we wanted.
What about the regimental mess? Was that the...
Well, that was run by PMC, and I didn't really have much connection with that, so I can't really give you much information about it.
Why weren't you connected? Was it just away from you? Or?
Oh, yes, no, it was in a different location. I mean, just in the same way as I wasn't, shall we say, linked up with B Company Mess. I think one of those, perhaps a little unusual time, was the fact that we were also short of transport. And all company commanders were told to go and find themselves a motorbike. And this is where I got a Rudge, which was a fairly stalwart in those days. Fred Kirkup, I remember, who was a pretty... before the war, he ran a Lagonda, which might indicate his ideas on motoring. But he got himself a four-square aerial, which if you took off too quickly, you were up to go arse over tip backwards... And it was a horrific piece of machinery from the point of view of sheer power. But that was something which was new to us. Vehicles, ultimately we got some impressed vehicles, in other words, civilian vehicles which had been requisitioned. Until very much later on, we got our regular army vehicles.